from Hanselminutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman, hosted by Carl Franklin. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 34, recorded Monday, September 25th, 2006. Support for Hansel Minutes is provided by Codesmith Tools, makers of Codesmith, an extensible template-based code generator for .NET. Hansel Minutes listeners get $100 off Codesmith Professional with coupon code HM100. Online at codesmithtools.com. And by AsPose, the .NET and Java component publisher. Hansel Minutes listeners get 20% off the price of any purchased product or suite with coupon code HM12345678. Online at www.aspose.com. Support is also provided by Slash N Software, makers of RSS Bus, letting you easily create RSS feeds from databases, spreadsheets, emails, and directories. Online at www.rssbus.com. Support is also provided by .NET Developers Journal, the world's leading .NET developer magazine. Online at www.sys-con.com. In this episode, Scott visits Chris Sells for open discussions on Vista, Xbox 360, Spelunking, and more.
Hi, this is Carl Franklin, and you're listening to Hansel Minutes. I'm not here with Scott this week. In fact, Scott is here with Chris Sells. He decided to do something a little bit different this week, took his portable rig over to Chris's house. They both live in Portland, Oregon. And here's the conversation that ensued.
This is Scott Hanselman, and this is Hansel Minutes. We're doing a little something different this week. I'm over at Chris Sells' house at Casa de Sells. And we're doing our very first Hansel Minutes show with a guest. So now you don't have to listen to me and Carl. You have to listen to me and Chris Sells. Thank you, Chris, for having me over to your house.
Oh, I'm happy to. At the very least, I just love when new people come to my house and I get to give the 15-minute mandatory, here's all the remodeling we did at my house. So you were a new victim. Thanks very much, Scott.
It was very lovely. I like the hardwood, but more importantly, the Xbox connected to the media center I thought was very
nice. Oh, yeah. And, you know, did you notice that the way the furniture was arranged in the family room, we had to have the LCD flat panel up on the fireplace? We had to buy that. Not because I wanted it. Oh, no. But because that's the only way to arrange the room.
Yes, clearly. A flat panel was required to make the remodeling work.
Absolutely right.
Fantastic. So you listened to our show. You drove up to Seattle and listened to our show in the car?
So what happens is that whenever I have a period of time when I've got some free time and I can't read, because I'm a reader, I will download a bunch of your shows. You know, maybe some. Just recently, I was driving back from Seattle, or I'm walking through airports, or standing in line at the bank, washing the dishes on a Saturday afternoon. You know, those kind of things. I download a bunch of shows, and then I listen to them. And then, because I happen to have your phone number on that same cell phone, whenever I have a problem with whatever you said, I call up and bitch directly, and it's a fabulous feedback loop.
So you had so many problems with the show that you had us come to your house so that we could hear them out in a complete full Chris Sells feeds back show. This is that show.
Well, actually, it's not that at all, because, you know, I know that I've had problems with individual shows, and I've called you, and you've been nice about it, right? But overall, I love the show so much that I've been after you for weeks to let me horn in on one. Just like Carl always let me horn in on the .NET show. So, plus, you're always so, whenever you're talking to Carl, right, Carl has a certain background and a certain sensibility. And that's great, because that represents a huge percentage of overall .NET developers. I just wanted to, Carl likes line continuation characters. I like semicolons. That's it. That's the whole difference.
Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Yes.
So you are coming at this from the curly braces, old school perspective.
Well, old school in the sense that I like to program a solution to a problem even when it's not warranted. That's what I consider old school.
Writing a solution when it's not warranted. What do you mean?
What I mean is, if I've got a problem in my life, the very first thing I think of is, how can I write a piece of software to solve it? As opposed to, there are people in the world, and arguably most programmers have problems to solve, and then they apply the appropriate tools. I only have one tool, software. And especially custom software. I mean,
I was just going to ask, how much software runs this house? I mean, I know how much custom software is running in my house. Between my X10 stuff, the baby cam, sure, the motion detector, sure, sure. I mean, the alarm system, the automation of Vonage. There's probably 12 craplets that I've written that are running my house. How much software is running this house?
So it's interesting. So I do a lot of software to run my own life, but I keep it almost all of it's on my laptop. And I have these little programs that do little things for me on my computer. And I'm constantly brainstorming new little things. But you've always had this wonderful ability to, you know, identify a problem in your life and solve it by just knowing of every piece of software that's ever been written by anyone. You've installed it all, tried it all, gotten to, you know, the obscure command line arguments that don't yet have documentation, figured out how those have worked, and then incorporated into your lives. So much so that, you know, it's handy to have you on that speed dial again, because then whenever I need something, you know, I know exactly who to ask.
Right, but what price installing everything in the world, right? I mean, I am living the dream right now. I've just installed Vista, and people always tease me because in Windows XP, when you click on the start menu and go all programs, on my 1600x1040 monitor, there's this gray curtain that drops when you hit all programs, and it fills the screen. My all programs goes, I think I get about up to P, and then it just kind of flows off the end of the right of part of the screen.
So ironically, for most people, all programs means all programs that you happen to have installed. In the case of Scott, that also equals all programs ever written anywhere ever by anyone.
Okay, which fills up the screen. So now on Vista, when I click all programs, I get this very sad scroll search menu. It's just not quite as impressive.
Oh,
they're not all there. It's not very Tufty-esque, right? It's not like I can't see that they're installed. I have to know that they're there. So I'm not digging the new start menu.
Well, it's funny. I have, you know, I used to run the Longhorn Dev Center, right? I mean, at MSDN, at Microsoft, right? And so I was living that dream every day, day to day, for 18 months. And then we have that big split, right, where Longhorn took a different turn and WinFX was split. And that was goodness. And now it's .NET 3.0. And that also was goodness, in my opinion, in terms of the naming. But that meant that the operating system went in a different way. And it was a while again before I could make it a part of my day-to-day life again. I always had whatever the latest bits were in terms of .NET 3.0. But in terms of Longhorn, lately, well, I guess we call it Vista now. Lately, my Vista experience has pretty much been a $300 Linux PC that I bought and then installed Vista on. And I got to use that computer for about 18 hours. And then my sons confiscated it, and now it's in their room. And it's been an excellent test of the operating system.
And what is the Windows Experience Index on this particular device?
The Windows Experience Index on this one is like 4.2.
For $300?
Yeah.
Oh, dude.
Yeah.
My custom-built Fry's PC, like, you know, lovingly nurtured RAID, this and that, 2 gigs of RAM, also 4.2.
Oh, really? That's
right,
funny.
Because that's the thing that's funny about the Experience Index. It's the lowest.
Right, whatever the lowest score is.
Mine was processor.
So for me, it was a tie between processor, which is a very low-end processor, and, you know, I didn't use the built-in graphics that came with my little PC. It was also a Fry's PC, a Fry's special. But I upgraded the video card to the 256 meg video card, but I only bought the $50 256 meg video card. So it's tied with the CPU for the low.
When did a Pentium 4 3 gigahertz become a low-end... A low-end processor.
I don't even think I've got that. I think I've got like a 1.6 Celeron.
But dude, that's what I have, and we're both at 4.2. So
and we're both CPU bound. That's
not cool. I've got hyper-threading and everything, so I don't know what's going on.
I got nothing. It's nothing.
See, my wife runs a $300 Fry's PC, which is apparently not as good as yours, and she has an Experience Index of 1. because she has the integrated Intel, you know, super not 3D.
Right.
She actually, when she runs Solitaire, the new like Avalon-based Windows Presentation Foundation Solitaire, it says unable to start hardware renderer, falling back to software rendering or something.
Oh, wow.
And she can't run Solitaire and Minesweeper at the same time.
Oh, man.
Use too much graphics
but
memory.
But wait, isn't this the same PC you just threw one of those ReadyBoost USB drives into? You said it was doing good things.
It is. It loads Solitaire faster than ever, then telling me that it can't render the graphics. But yeah, it does load faster. I mean, when I ran a test yesterday where I had Excel and Word and Outlook all running at the same time, and that swapping back and forth, it's just, it's night and day. I mean, ReadyBoost took this little 512 meg box and gave it life again. Now, my 2 gig box, I haven't really noticed a difference yet.
Sure.
My 768 meg tablet, my Toshiba tablet,
sure,
it did have a little kick.
So you noticed that Vista was, in fact, faster on that box than XP.
And it's interesting to watch the light on the USB drive, because then you get a sense of when is it that it's reading from this, because the USB drive has a light.
Oh, sure. So you can tell.
It's your disk access light, right?
Right,
so
you can.
You can hear kind of moments of quiet in the hard drive when it's instead reading from the USB drive. I'd like to get a hold of some of those stress testers that they showed at TechEd where they were demonstrating ReadyBoost, so I could find out is SuperFetch really working?
Well, I mean, isn't the little green light enough for you?
Well, I just expected to go into Task Manager and see physical memory, virtual memory, and then ReadyBoost-a-roo or something show up as another graph.
Actually, I would be surprised if it wasn't in there. You know, they got like every possible metric under the sun in Task Manager.
You know, that's a good point. And if there isn't, it's probably in Perfmon.
Yeah, yeah. I bet it is in there.
Yeah.
They do, in general, I've noticed they do an excellent job making that data available.
So let me ask you this. Why am I suffering with Vista? I've got drivers this and this, and I mean the software stuff's working. I mean, I'm running .NET Framework. I'm developing on the .NET Framework 3.0. Card Spaces works great. WPF works great. Indigo's works great. So all of the WinFX stuff is great. What are people are complaining, right? I mean, let's just be real. People are bitching about Vista. Is it really just drivers that they're complaining about?
I wonder about that. The only driver issue I had with, like they say, this little $300 PC was for beta 1 and beta 2, the sound drivers didn't work. And it was my understanding they were doing still big magic on the sound. But an RC1, it magically works just fine. And
that's it.
Yeah, and it just works. I can't be sure. But I'm guessing it has something to do with, there's a whole new driver model in Vista, right? And so that driver model is all about performance and robustness, okay? And so every time you have a new driver model, you've got, you've got to decide how to deal with legacy drivers, and I don't know what the decisions they made there were. And you have to, if you're not dealing with legacy drivers, get new drivers with the new driver model. And my guess is that the legacy driver support to live up to the robustness isn't letting in some drivers that maybe would add to more capability or compatibility, but would decrease robustness.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you think about it, the PC was fabulous because it's general purpose and does absolutely everything, and you can plug any old thing into it, and you can write software to do any old thing. But the problem with that is where it's great for geeks, right? You and I love that. And every time they turn a little knob and make it more robust, they take away capabilities and we complain, right? And we write the blogs and we complain and people see, right? We're the loud minority, right? So that's fine, except most people use PCs and they're not willing to have it crash. And they're not willing to have it allow insecure things to happen. They're just not. Most people want their computer to work as a VCR, right? They just want to turn it on.
Bill wants it to work as a VCR, right?
Yes.
The whole on, you know, always on or on quicker or whatever it's called. You know, push a button, come out of sleep mode,
and it's intuitive and it just works and it never crashes and it always does what you expect and it protects you from the hostile world. We have an ecosystem in the internet that is increasingly capable, and it's capable of good, and it's capable of evil. Just like any ecosystem in wild. I mean, we're talking about, at this point, a natural system, right? Where nobody's in control, and it evolves on its own, and bad things and good things happen in equal measure. And so the individual nodes at the end, to provide that same safe and happy experience, have had to evolve very quickly. So I would even argue that one of the goals that the Xbox team had was, let's start over with a machine where we can bake in security and robustness as first-class citizens and an intuitive interface, and give people an a VCR-like experience. At the same time, notice that over time, Xbox 360 gets more and more capable. The big-ticket items that people want to do with their PC, right? All the media stuff. It's not just for playing games.
Right, but the difference is that an Xbox 360 is tantamount to a Mac, because it is a platform with one hardware platform. There's not a Dell Xbox 360 and a HP Xbox 360.
Agreed. Totally.
There is one. And the reason that I think that Apple succeeds so dramatically is that there's one with security robustness, and it just, Apple's work. You push a button, it turns on. Because there's only one hardware platform. There's only one driver to have. I mean, you get your little peripherals, you got your USB cam, but there's really only one motherboard chipset to support.
Yeah.
There's only one power management system to support.
Or there's N chipsets, right? Because they change them themselves.
Sure.
But they have, warehouses filled with all the old computers,
right.
And they can walk up and definitively know this is every possible combination or nearly
right.
every possible
I can't
combination.
Go to Fry's and say, I'd like to buy a Mac motherboard
right.
and a Taiwan chipset
and so,
or whatever.
You know, consoles are very like that. But as we get to next gen consoles, especially the 360 and probably the PS3, not so much the Wii, I don't think, we will get to a point where they have more and more capability, where they're starting to encroach on the PC world. For example, you wrote a blog entry about, gosh, I can keep all my media on my PC. And if it happens to be a media center PC, which is specifically about managing media, then there is a way to hook it through a 360. But even if it's not, there is a whole other, streaming API that the Xbox and the PC both support for getting that media and sharing it. So we're starting to really get to the point where, people have asked the question, why is a 360 a media center extender and not a media center?
I'm asking that question now because right now I'm having some trouble with my drivers in Vista, and I'm having trouble plugging in some removable drives. And a couple of days ago, I had this sense that my media was not safe. Where exactly is it? I need it to be somewhere that is secure, is backupable, and is available from anywhere. Ordinarily, it's been on my main Vista PC. It's been unreliable. So I moved that drive over to the media center, and then chaos ensued. Because now drive letters have changed, the location of all the media changed.
Sure, sure, sure.
So the Windows media library gets confused.
Yep.
It's got to rebuild the whole library. I've got 8,000 songs.
Wow.
Right. I mean, this is a non-trivial amount of music. I went to ripdigital.com and I had those guys.
Yeah. I was wondering about that. You sent them your big stack of CDs and they sent you back high quality MP3s, WMAs.
They sent me MP3s. This is back in the day.
High quality.
192 KB. On a bunch of DVDs.
I'm a dyed-in-the-wool MP3 fan, too. I've ripped all my own stuff to MP3. And this was, when we had WMA, which, for all intents and purposes is higher quality. But in terms of support and compatibility, I want to be able to buy a song and use it everywhere.
I got Vista, right? I put it in my box. Suddenly iTunes wants me to authorize again.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same box.
Yes, but in terms of iTunes and how it determines sameness, is different.
So now iTunes puts out this ominous, you have used 4 out of 5 of your authorizations.
Yep, yep, yep.
4 out of 5? Holy, I got one machine.
Yep.
Oh my gosh.
Yep.
So now I got this.
Well, hopefully Apple, Audible does the same kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm a big Audible fan.
I am too. Huge Audible fan.
But Audible has this great thing where you can say, okay, here's the list of all the PCs that have been authorized. And if you want, you can take some of the old ones off the list.
Where can I do this? This is on their website?
Yeah.
Okay. See, because right now I'm having trouble because Audible thinks I've maxed out as well, and they won't let me deauthorize from my iTunes.
I have done it before where I've gone to the website, right. And I imagine Apple's got to have a similar thing.
Well, yeah, I think probably got to call them and yell at them or complain or something. Because the thing is, they say they want you to go to the PC and deauthorize first. So the right thing for me to have done would have been deauthorize before the upgrade, but I didn't. Yeah. So now that PC is gone.
Yeah.
And I can never get
exactly.
back.
Exactly. And of course, it's completely impractical for them to expect you to remember to go and deauthorize.
Yeah.
Because it's not like we get, with DRM becoming more and more prevalent, it's not like one PC only has one source.
So I'm not going to use WMA. Because it's not going to play on my, and I'm not going to use AAC because I love Mac, but I don't love them that much.
Yep.
So I'm going to go with MP3.
Yep.
Except for all my MP4s, which are the ones that I bought from iTunes.
Now, have you been doing this? Have you been like buying TV shows and movies?
Not TV shows and movies, because I just will buy the DVD.
Right.
I'll use like PSP Video 9 and I'll just squish it and put it on my PlayStation Portable.
Right.
And I get a much bigger screen, a battery life that's like 10 hours long. I don't have an iPod with the video support.
So I have, I had occasion, I don't know, about 6 to 9 months ago where somebody had a little, WMA based video player and somebody had a video iPod. Now, like I said, this was 6 to 9 months ago. So who knows, things might have changed. But at the time, it was amazing the difference in quality between the iPod video and the WMA. I mean, the iPod video was twice as good.
In clarity and brightness
the
and
whole,
crispness.
And, this was the mandatory demo, right? He said, okay, so you're watching a movie, right? The guy who owned the thing. And I had the headphones in and the whole thing. He's like, watch this. He reached over, grabbed the iPod video, pulled the microphone cord out, which happens all the time. You're on a plane, you've got it in your pocket, whatever, right? The thing comes out all the time. And he looked at the movie. It had noticed that you'd pulled out the microphone or the headset, and it had paused the movie. I mean, it's as opposed to, oh crap, I gotta find it, plug it in, rewind, find where I was. Just that kind of attention to detail. I mean, those guys are fabulous.
So I'm looking at an iRiver Clix, the Clix.
Yep.
I'm thinking about that. So I'm going to maybe take a look at one of those to see if the user, and then there's the Zune, right?
Well, so the Zune, so this is the thing. I'm looking forward to the Zune, although Brown mystifies me. But I'm looking forward to see if it has that same attention to detail that the Apple. And I'm not saying the same features, right? But it's a unit of delight, right? When you do something that normally you're not supposed to do, but you do it anyway, and the right thing happens anyway, right? Unit of delight.
So let me ask you this. Why is it that someone can work on a project, an iTunes, a Clix, a Zune, or whatever, Vista, and then myself or anyone else on the internet or anyone listening installs it and out of the box has a bad experience? Even though it's been tested for 3 years, it's been installed 15 million times, happen to have that crappy experience. And then one asks themselves, has anyone ever installed this before?
Yeah, I've seen that happen a ton of times, both for Microsoft products and not Microsoft products.
Of course.
And I think it boils down to the fact that fundamentally engineers build systems based on the normal scenarios, right? These are how we expect the user to interact with the system. And that's fine, except we're humans, and A, we don't know how we're supposed to interact with the system, so we're just doing the best we can. And B, even if we do know, we still make mistakes. And so what I think happens is we design the systems, hardware, software combinations, for this set of scenarios. And as engineers, we use the thing as we build it. And we build up so much knowledge of how the thing is built and designed that we just automatically go down those, trusted paths where things work. And we just I think we even block it out as engineers. We block out the stuff we know doesn't work. We just don't even think, it doesn't exist anymore as a possibility. And so I think, I have noticed over the years in various teams that I've seen internally, like Vista, I've seen what those guys do. and .NET 3.0, right? I've seen what those guys do. And the better, of course, you know, it's not, Vista's not one team, right? It's a gajillion. And the better subsystems in Vista and the better subsystems in .NET 3.0 are the ones where, even towards the end, they're getting it in customers' hands, they're taking feedback, and they're making changes, even though, right, they use it in a way that it's not meant to be used, and we still want to enable that.
The pit of success.
Exactly right. We want to push everyone into the pit of success. Absolutely right.
So I've got this Nano, iPod Nano, 2 gigs. I've got the new...
Do you have it with you?
Yeah.
I want to see it.
I've got the new...
This is the new one, right?
No. This is the crappy old one.
Oh, well.
You don't want to see that. This here it is.
But it's still pretty cool.
Yeah, it's tiny. You could be careful you don't accidentally swallow it. It's that small. So I got iTunes 7, right? So we have 7 versions of iTunes here.
Do you have all 7?
No, I'm just saying that they have built 7 versions. Yes, so you think that, you know, it's not 2005 versions of Visual Studio, but they've had some time. They've had some time to potentially work on this. So here's the deal. It's a 2 gig El Cheapo. It's the cheap one, right? It's the Nano with 2 gigs,
yeah,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
So I want to plug it in to my machine.
Yeah.
And I want to say, keep in mind, I've got 6,000 songs, right? So I've got, you know,
not
I don't
on
know.
The iPod now.
No, on my computer.
For sure.
So I've got 20 or 30 gigs. I think it's like 30 gigs of music, right?
Sure.
I want to say, give me 2 gigs of the good stuff off the top.
Sure.
That seems reasonable, right?
Can't you do that?
So, no.
But they do have this whole thing where they have ratings.
Okay,
so, and they do this careful thing where you're allowed to rate it on the device and you can sync the ratings with your PC.
Well, so the issue is now that there's other kinds of content that you can put on your system. You can put podcasts, contacts from Outlook, calendars from Outlook, photographs.
You can put contacts in here?
Yeah. I can go here and I can say extras, contacts.
Well, this will be... So I've heard that they're
find
doing
Chris Sells.
I heard that they're doing games in this thing too. Like they have an iPod version of Tetris.
Oh yeah.
And you know it won't be a real platform until they can run Doom, right? That's the.
Oh, they can run Doom on this.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. So here, there awesome. You go.
There you go.
So there's Rich Clausen pulled out
yep.
of the.
I know Rich. Yep.
So I've got context. So here's the thing: I got context, I got podcasts, I got photos, all on the iPod. I just want to say, and with the extra space, give me some music.
Oh, I say. So you want to say, give me a gig. I've got a whatever's left.
Whatever's left.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So
yeah.
I made a list, and I called the list 1 gig,
mm-hmm.
which is
yep,
the
I
list
see
of music. Yeah.
Yep.
But that's, I want to say, with the rest. So right now, I'm sitting here with a 2 gig iPod with a half a gig empty. Wasted.
Because
there's no way in the interface to say, I want this, this, and this. I don't want to have more than 300 megs for podcasts.
That's weird. So there's no quota system.
Well, because it's all done by list, like playlist. So you can say...
And so you have to manually create such a list. You can't just say, let me give you some rules. Then that's what you want, right?
Exactly. That's all I want.
You want to
it seems reasonable. And it's just... That's an example of maybe that's an unreasonable expectation that I have. But, you know,
aww.
Yeah, just got a picture of the baby now on the iPod. And if you move it really fast, it looks like he's talking.
Yeah. It's like your own personal little flip book.
So that's an example of, you know, people have been using this for 7 versions and suddenly I feel all alone from a user experience perspective. Am I the first guy who's ever wanted to say, I'd like to fill up the rest of it?
Oh, no.
The Shuffle supports that, but not the Nano.
Oh, really? The Shuffle does?
Apparently the Shuffle, you can just say... Give me a bunch of random music up to this point.
And it gets a quota.
And I guess so. I haven't seen a Shuffle, but that's what I heard.
Wow, that's cool.
So I'm really interested in... And here's a good question. So from a user experience perspective, we've got 7 versions of iTunes, 11 versions of Media Player. What is that feeling that you get when you load Media Player, Windows Media Player, and there's that kind of, where the hell am I? Right? There's that kind of... Did you ever get lost in Media Player?
So I haven't gotten lost in Media Player, but I have definitely gotten lost in software. And I definitely get lost in software where, like Project. Microsoft Project. I sat down, this was years ago when I was running a little software arm of Developmentor. And I felt like, okay, I want to use what Project is supposed to be good at. I've got a bunch of tasks and subtasks, and I've got timing estimates, and I've got resources, and I want to lay that out in a calendar. But I mostly wanted to know how long it was going to take. I think of it as a calendar, but, you know, Gantt chart, absolutely. And so the problem with project at the time was I'd never done any project management using Gantt charts, using project, using software specific for this. So I entered all the data, but I couldn't get the reporting and the Gantt chart and any of that to roll up the way I suspected it should. I just couldn't figure out the interface. And the basic problem was that there was a core idea inside of project about how you specify the data and how things roll up. And then once you have it in using that core idea, right, the right metaphor, then you could do whatever you, what you wanted with the software. So I called up, for the first time in my life, I called up the Microsoft help desk on their consumer side, right, not on the developer side, which I've never called either. But I called on the consumer side and I waited and they had little, you know, they had their own DJ that was mixing music and giving like little news reports and weather around the country from where people were calling.
So Microsoft's Hold music is its own radio station?
DJ? Yeah, they have a DJ and yeah, it was really cool. It was actually, that was a part of the fun part of the experience. And then I got a guy who knew Project and I told him what I was trying to do and he detected that I just didn't understand the whole thing, right? The whole. So we literally spent like 90 minutes and he taught me what the core abstractions were in the project, in Microsoft Project, and how to rearrange my data. And then how do I get the report that did exactly what I wanted? It was a fabulous experience. But it's not the only one I've ever had, right? I mean, that's a good one. That turned out well. The out of box experience is not something that just happens, right? Because I think what happens is, with any hardware or software platform, there's two real modes. There's what happens when I first turn the thing on, how do I get my head into it? And then there's, okay, I've found the features that I like, and I know how to use them, and I've learned to ignore all the rest, right? And most software, I'd say, is fairly good at the once you've learned where everything is and making it work. It generally does work.
Word perfect, right? Yeah. Shift F7. That's yeah. Totally obvious. That's how you print. Right. We came built in knowing that Shift F7 is how you print.
But once you do know Shift F7 prints, by God, Shift F7 prints, right? But it's that out of box, you know, how do I print?
Blue screen.
Right.
That's why I hate Vim.
Oh, because you, well, see, I grew up as a VI guy, and then I spent a very painful summer doing Emacs, like 3 months. I had to leave. The guy who taught me Emacs taught me how to start it up, and then he went on vacation for 2 weeks, and he didn't tell me how to exit Emacs. So Emacs ran on my machine for 2 weeks, because I couldn't figure out what the freaking key combination was to turn it off. And then, of course, there's the carpal tunnel I gave myself with the alt, meta, left elbow key combinations that I never could figure out. I mean, I'm not an Emacs guy.
So if we had some other people here, like maybe like John Lamb or some of these guys that are hardcore VI, Vim types, Emacs types, maybe Don Box.
Don, Martin Gudgeon, these are hardcore Emacs guys.
Wouldn't these guys argue that, yes, maybe the out-of-box experience sucks, but if you just let it flow over you, just drink it in, then you are a ninja and you can take over the world.
And absolutely, you're absolutely right. I mean, once you're into Emacs, the whole mental model is fabulous. I've been able to grok, get a kind of a look in terms of the mental model of what makes Emacs Emacs. It's not a text editor. It's an editor, right? It's an editor environment. And that's what makes Emacs so wonderful. And you can build all these apps and there's a ton of things you can do with it. And it's a fabulous mental model once you get there. But the out of box experience for Emacs is the worst. It sucks. And of course, VI is there too. Absolutely.
So that's really interesting because when you take that combination, a crappy out of box experience and an unbelievably powerful underlying thing, mm-hmm. then you end up with very fervent supporters, like fanatical people. Like if you only could understand this, like with me and Code Rush, right?
Yes.
Like Code Rush is better now because in the 2.0 version, they have a training window that basically suggests, you know, in this context, you ought to push this hotkey.
Sure.
And that's cool, but it took them two versions to do it.
Sure.
Before, I was like, oh no, dude, if you type NTLFS, LPSCR, you'll get a, you know, and you'll get this great macro.
Yes. Oh, totally.
And I was kind of spitting against the wind.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And of course, I'm not a CodeRus user, but Calm. You know, Calm is the classic example of this, right? I mean, we used to, about Wednesday, you'd look out into the audience of people you've been teaching all week about how to use Calm. And you'd see this glazed over look, and they're and it's like some of them are rubbing their foreheads. And at that point, I'd say, you know what? If you resist, it just hurts more. Just let it wash over you. The headache will go away, and suddenly Calm, you know, Calm will make sense. And by the end of the week, that was the case. But man, it hurt in the middle.
You just said that let it wash over you. I've said that so many times in training sessions for like XML or the .NET framework. You know, all right, well the .NET. You remember the first thing that they do in that program, like most .NET framework classes, is they run the reflection thing. They go, here's reflection. Let's reflect over the entire framework. There's 275,000, you know, and then the very first slide for WinFX is like, we've added an additional 87,000.
Like, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, that's great.
I remember my first probably 6 months as a .NET framework guy. I was enjoying C Sharp and I was enjoying Visual Studio and that whole experience. And I was really enjoying not freeing memory, right? I mean, that was fabulous. It was like 40% less code right off the top. But it was so frustrating because I would be writing my program and I'd get to, oh, I need a program to calculate a hash or to crack an URL or to. So I would write my little routine and I'd show off my program to somebody and they'd go, well, dude, why didn't you just use that piece of code or there or there? It's all built in. It's all right there. I'm like, oh, God, because that was the big deal, right? All the stuff that's there. And I still to this day can't say that I know all the stuff. A tiny fraction I know.
Yeah, you know. Path.io.combine or URL URI.
Actually, I feel in love with the path manipulation stuff. I know that one. I like those.
But you know, but there's always that one thing you don't need. You know, that you don't have. Rather, you know, you have to go and write a thing like, does it have a, like, was it path is rooted?
I don't know about that one. I know that I definitely had to write the thing where it'll create you a temp file, but it doesn't have the. It won't create the temp directories.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Right. So I had to write that. And, you know, it's of course, it's never going to do everything.
Sure, sure, sure.
Otherwise, well, luckily for us, otherwise we couldn't justify our unreasonably high salaries.
So trying to tie these things back together, the idea of the out-of-box experience when you get a or an iPod?
I can't tell you since I didn't know the next word in the sentence, ahead.
Is it an historical or
it's
ahistorical?
It's an historical. It's an iPod.
So he hit an home run.
He hit a home run.
Okay. Well, so if there's the out-of-box experience on an iPod for, like, you know, my wife, who's like the canonical example, right? Our spouses are always
Example. There's always the, what is it? The WAF, right? The wife acceptance factor.
Exactly. And then there's the out-of-box experience for the .NET framework or Vista or, sure. or framework 3.0. With both of them, we have to tell the user, like I've told my wife, you know, just let it wash over you. I know the iPod isn't incredibly intuitive. Because with the one where you can turn the wheel.
You know, it took me 90 minutes to figure out on an iPod that I wasn't supposed to be pressing on these little buttons, that I was supposed to be moving my thumb over the thing.
It's very confusing.
I'd never seen one used. I bought one. I brought it home. It's not in the manual. It doesn't say, rub your thumb around the thing. It doesn't. I know.
See, but they say that the design is evocative of caressing something. So you're supposed to just discover that, right?
No, the hard metal plastic thingy in my hand, not big caressing. No.
But it's just like they said that, you know, they made the start menu because they wanted to make it discoverable.
Right.
Right. Anyone, assuming they can buy into the whole mouse metaphor.
Right.
Right.
Which, you know,
which is totally, my wife's family has come over from Zimbabwe and I tried to teach her mom how to use a mouse and it was like, it wasn't going to happen. It's a non-trivial thing. She
couldn't connect the movement of the hand to the movement of this little triangle.
So what do I do? I flip it over trying to show her the mouse ball. It's not there anymore. There's a laser. I picked it up. I flipped it over. Like, well, you see, Mom, there's this. Oh, well, there used to be this ball. Ah, damn it. Well, there's a little tiny camera, and it's taking lots of pictures and extrapolate. And I lost her there.
Yeah, of course. That doesn't help.
So we've got this out-of-box experience. With out-of-box experience with anything, whether it be a consumer product, whether it be my remote control or the .NET Framework 3.0 or Vista, is there always going to have to be that moment of pressure as we push and we say, just let it wash over you. You'll get it in a second.
I don't think there is. And in fact, I think that one of the things that makes that gives Apple the mind share across almost all of their products and, you know, market share when it comes to MP3 players is that they have found the ability to combine an amazing out-of-box experience, an amazing end-to-end experience, and over time, those little units of delight in ways that even as you go forward, even if you, Scott Hanselman, get to a place where, gosh, I wish I could, but I can't, I bet you still have features that you have yet to find in your iPod Nano that will make you go, wow, I didn't know it did that. That's really cool.
I actually just upgraded the Nano yesterday because I plugged it in. It said, oh, you've got a new, there's a new version. Want to download the firmware? And I did. And they had a feature for maximum volume. Never seen before. You can set the volume in the iPod to only go to a certain
level. No matter how you might accidentally crank the volume. Oh, that's cool.
Discovered that. I've never seen that before.
There you go.
But do I want to have this sense of a kind of spelunking? And like, I don't like going into Vista now and like on a 1600 size monitor, 19 inch monitor, the control panel flies open bigger than the monitor. So a while,
does it really?
Yeah. So a while back, a couple days ago, I decided to scroll down a bit to see what was happening in like T through Z. Discovered a whole bunch of stuff in the depths. Of
wow! Look at this W. I'm a big W
fan.
And
you know what I found down there? Windows firewall. Thank God, Windows. I could have seen Mac firewall. I could have seen just firewall.
Right.
No,
right.
I saw Windows
as opposed
firewall.
To the Windows display settings.
I am running
Windows, this,
Windows
or the Windows that. They could have put that in front of everything.
Their little reminder, like Jeff Abwood just blogged about this. He had a screenshot of the start menu with Windows in front of every single word, right? Because Windows Solitaire, Windows Calculator,
as if you'd forget.
Exactly. Well, like at our company, all of our database tables have Carillion in front of, like, you know, so it's just in case the company might change its name. So we might forget who we're working
and
for.
And heaven forbid it does change your name, because then you have to search through all the software and change all the strings, and it'll take months.
It's huge.
Yeah.
What were we talking about?
We were talking about, you know, is it okay to do spelunking, right?
Right?
To require spelunking to get to things.
The device that Microsoft has come out with that is the closest to the iPod in just glorious, wonderful, what did you call it?
Units of delight.
Units of delight is the freaking Xbox 360.
The 360 is there.
Holy crap.
I'm a huge 360 fan. Absolutely. I mean, it has simplified my life and gave me the ability
to
do all kinds of
stuff. Have you plugged
the
digital camera into the front of it before?
No.
Dude,
you can do
you've
that?
Got a digital camera right there. I'm looking
I do.
At it.
Yeah.
So you take the USB deal on it, plug it into the USB port in the front, and it immediately recognizes it and displays the photos.
You're kidding
we
me.
We have to do that today.
That's awesome. I had no idea.
Take your iPod or any MP3 player or any USB stick with MP3s on it.
Oh, I knew about that.
Plug
one.
It into the front.
I knew about that
and
one.
It just works.
Yep.
So we had friends over that had a digital camera. I took a USB cable. I plugged it in. It just worked.
Well, so I didn't know you could do that because I had a cousin over. She had been abroad in Spain for a while. She had a ton of pictures, and I volunteered my house so she could have like a little party for her friends and family and whatever, right? And so I took all of her. She gave me just a CD full of pictures, and so I dumped them on the media center, and then I played them that way through my Xbox 360,
right? There's just something nerdy about the nerd needs to run into the server room. And install this
thing. But that's the thing. That's what the media center is, right? It's a media server. Now, the fact that I also have it connected to my television upstairs, that almost seems wrong.
Why couldn't you have put the CD in your Xbox and had it uploaded to your media server?
Or just...
I mean, we have a trust relationship, presumably, between the Xbox.
Yes, yes.
And
or forget about that. Why didn't it just take the CD and play them? And you know what? It might have. I just didn't think to try it.
That'd be a very interesting thing to try. I don't know. But those USB ports in the front are just amazing. I've been plugging stuff. We'll plug your camera and we'll take a look at how
it works. So you just plug random stuff in and wonder what happens?
Yeah. Totally. Didn't you? Dude, I got an Xbox. The first thing I did is I said, yeah. USB. I plugged the keyboard in. Works just great.
Does it really?
Dude, totally.
Oh, man. Have you seen the Xbox 360 laptop this guy built?
What?
Yeah, what he did was he took a laptop chassis and he, you know, the screen and the place for the guts and the, you know, the little roller ball. And he took out all the laptop bits and he put in all the Xbox 360 bits and the place for the DVD drive. And, you know, you'd press the big green button and it would just play the Xbox stuff on the monitor. And it was. It's totally awesome. Yeah, it works. And, you know, you could put the keyboard there. And you have, did you try a USB mouse? Does that work too?
No. No cursor.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wondered if it would appear. Because that's what happens with the media center.
What I did is I tried to play Doom, right?
Well, you need the keyboard
Doom
for that.
3, and I wanted to do it with the keyboard. Yeah, couldn't totally do that. Oh, but no. Like in like Fantasy Star, one of these chat things, you can type the chat.
And of course, the reason is the games just don't even think to take keyboard input because it doesn't ship with the keyboard.
Oh, actually, speaking of keyboard input, little tangent here. I've got this IR thing that's controlling a robot. So I've got this function, right? IR infrared dot send. And when I do a send, with my, this is a little class I wrote, it sends the forward command to the robot.
Okay.
So then I wrote a little console app and I say, you know, while console dot check key or read key or whatever it is. I'm just checking for the one key. And then I have a switch statement and then I push the button and it goes.
Sure.
So that works great with one button press. If I hold down the keyboard, then I get key repeats and the buffer fills up. So then I let go of the keyboard and then the IR, the program keeps reading that buffer like, you know, 30 seconds.
Right.
How can I get from a console app or a WinForms app or whatever? So then I put it in a WinForms app.
Right.
So I did, I put key preview equals true. I said key down, key up.
Right.
And then I held down the key. I made a background worker thread that would basically fire off. And then when the key came up, then I would cancel the thing. Right. But, The repeating, though, kept causing these events to fire. I'm saying that as I hold down the key, I keep going key down, key down, key down, key down.
Right.
How do I get, do I need to use direct input in order to get I want the IR to be on when the key's down.
Right.
And off when the key's up. Right. I just want to know, I want a status. I want to spin like, while true, if key is
actually,
down.
I think what you really want is you want the key down so you can send forward, and you want the key up so you can send stop.
But I want forward has to repeat though. It needs to act like a remote control. You hold a button on your remote control.
Oh, I see.
And it sprays.
I see. Forward. So it's not the case that once you send the robot forward that it keeps
continues.
Going.
No, you click it and it goes forward, and then it just goes.
Well, so there's no problem there then because you just watch for the key down and the key up, and then you have another thing that says, well, we've had a key down, but no key up, so we'll keep sending.
So in the WinForms app, when I hold the key down, the entire form flashes.
The entire form flashes?
Like I put a bunch of buttons on it, so the form kind of like shakes. Because
So you built yourself a little earthquake detector.
I don't know. I basically, the form's key down event, not the event of the button or a text box, but literally the form itself.
Sure.
Is vibrates. It kind of shakes like the key repeat rate kind of kicks in and then all chaos is ensued. You know, it seems like it would make sense. I just want to know that it's continuing to be pressed.
Right.
But I'm getting these repeated events. What I really want is just to ask the system, hey system, what's the status of that key? That's totally against
you
the
model. You can do that.
The model.
It is against the model, but there are multiple layers of abstraction in the model. And there is a global mouse class where you can say mouse is button down, is button up, and you can do the same with the keyboard. And it's just system level as opposed to, you know, the next layer of abstraction, which is, you know, repeating and blah, blah, blah.
This is in system dot what?
Probably system dot windows dot forms dot keyboard, system dot windows dot forms dot mouse is probably where it is.
So it'll work in forms. I'll have to check your book.
I'm sure it is in the book.
Yeah,
wrote it down and flushed the memory.
Yeah, he was looking up to his. What do we got up here? You've got Windows Forms and the complete Frank Miller Spider-Man next to each other. He's got all the good books here. So, you know, that's an example. Like, I was trying to get it to work in the console.
Right.
And I struggled. And I don't, if you just said system.forms. You know, system.windows.forms, it's probably not available from the console. I have to do something else to figure out status of the keyboard.
It depends on what you mean, right? I mean, define available. Could you write a console app that included system.windows.forms.dll? Absolutely.
I don't know. Would you have to fire up a message pump and then you're going to be watching this stuff? And how are you going to be watching the keyboard?
Again, remember, it's the system global state, right? So it's not about firing events. It's about what is the state.
So this gets into the stuff that people get frustrated about with the framework where something that was global ended up in some lower down world. Like if there is a keyboard class like you described that's in Windows.forms, but really could be used anywhere.
Yeah, but you just generally wouldn't use it everywhere, right? I mean, well, so here's the question. Because we have this problem all the time. I work on a product design team inside of the Connected Systems division at Microsoft, right? These are the guys that own Indigo and BizTalk and Workflow and a bunch of those. And I work in a little team. And we're constantly, it's amazing how much time we spend arguing about what do we name something? Do we create a new interface or not? Every time we do, you know, you've got new concepts you've got to teach to people. What about the existing concepts in the framework? Are they the same? Can you reuse them? Do you really need a new thing?
How do you push it up to another group? Like, I know that Rob Howard years ago was working on system.web.caching, built the cache for ASP.NET, right? Mm-hmm. But it's an app domain level cache. They wanted to call it system.caching.
Sure.
But, you know, politics and this and that and the hassle of moving it up, you know, basically over one dot.
Right.
It was just too much.
But that constant, I mean, okay, so in that case, it might have been too much. But it constantly happens, right? There's a bunch of stuff in system or system.component model in .NET 3.0 that was built by the Avalon team. But they wanted it. It was more general purpose. They wanted it in a shared location. That has to happen, right? People have to be able to do it. Is it a headache? Sure, because the further up the hierarchy in the namespaces you push something, the more likely people are going to get to it, the more concepts they'll run into when they're looking for the thing they're really looking for, et cetera, right?
But the thing that's funny, though, is that when people, when those things don't happen, like when system.web.caching doesn't get moved, and then I or someone recommends we use it in a console app, chaos ensues. Panic.
Well, so for example,
I want to use Microsoft.Visual Basic. No, don't pervert the...
Oh, exactly. So if I'm... Yeah. In the book, in the WinForms 2 book, we talk about... In the first version of the book, we said, if you want to do single instance detection, we built a bunch of the services and we provide a class and you can use it from C#, you can use it from VB, and that's fine, right? In WinForms 2.0, the VB team wanted that functionality baked in. But it's not in system.windows.forms. It's system.visualbasic or whatever the namespace they own. And it's in that that DLL. So in my Windows Forms book, I say, okay, so it's baked in. You can use real engineered, tested, supported code from Microsoft by that does this thing in your C# apps by simply bringing in the Visual Basic DLL. And
it
that just feels...
freaks people out.
Yes, it does.
The Visual Basic guys... You know,
they already have it. They're fine.
They don't have a problem.
Right.
But the C# guys treat them like they're lepers.
Yep. And there's a ton of really great stuff in there too. I mean, that's not the only thing. There's all kinds of wonderful parsing and all this, you know, stuff that essentially used to be built into the interpreter in Visual Basic is still there. See, and it's still useful.
We do the same thing with system.web. We like, well, we really would rather not have a reference to system.web in our console app. Well, why not? Well, it's because, we don't really have a reason, but it doesn't really feel right.
Well, it increases the working set, and there's a performance of loading another DLL. And so, for example, when you're writing ClickOnce apps, you can know what the arguments were if you say, example.com/foo/foo.application?" And then that whole query string to pass command line arguments to your ClickOnce app. It'll install and do whatever it needs to do. And you can get the ClickOnce arguments. But what you get is ?, blah. You get the string. So what do you do? Do you parse it and write a little parsing code? Do you bring in system.web so you can get all of their wonderful, very wonderful parsing code? Do you dig in with Reflector and just pull out the little bits need? What do you do? So that's in general a problem.
Yeah.
And so it's a constant battle between what number of concepts do you want to push to the wider scope versus where do you think people will actually think to look for that stuff? Right? Will I think to look for query string parsing in system and have it be an MS-CoreLib, in which case MS-CoreLib is monstrous, or will I actually think to look for it in system.web?
See, and tying all of this back to the out-of-box experience and my kind of original questions on Vista, I was poking around in the now harder-to-browse all programs stuff in the start menu in Vista. I discovered Windows DVD Maker in Vista. You can make
yeah,
DVDs.
Yeah.
I discovered Windows Meeting. Was it Meeting Place or Meeting?
Yeah, it's like a little peer-to-peer data sharing thing.
It's like not quite NetMeeting again, or it's some kind of NetMeeting.
I think actually, I haven't run that. I've only heard, but I think it's like a peer-to-peer file sharing kind of a thing.
But when you find stuff like that, when you literally are wandering around in a neighborhood that you thought you knew, and you go, wow, when did they build that house?
But isn't that... So the question is...
Will those people stay? Will they move out of the neighborhood, right? If I bet my company on Windows collaboration meetings applet thing, and then it disappears like NetMeeting.
Okay, but maybe NetMeeting's no longer in the start menu, but it's still in, at least in Windows XP. It's still there.
It's not in Vista anywhere.
Is it in Vista? I don't actually know if it's in Vista or not. I would be surprised
I'll
if it wasn't in Vista.
I bet you $1, it's probably not.
I got a bucket that says it's still there. Because Microsoft, in general, is darn good about... They might say something is obsolete or you shouldn't use it.
Yeah.
But they're damn good about leaving it there if you want to.
Yeah.
So.
I wish there was a way in Vista right now, and I think maybe the Welcome Center is that, which is the guide people to the dozen things that they really need. I mean, that's what the Mac... That dock at the bottom of the Mac, right? That object bar.
Sure.
Does a good job of doing. It's like, here's the six things you need.
Cool.
iLife. You know,
right.
That's what they call
it, right? And of course, iLife is just an umbrella for a bunch of other stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
It's like Microsoft Works.
Well, I would argue that the start menu was our version of that.
Yeah.
Right?
But the start, everything is a peer, right? In the start menu.
Oh, that's not true at all, right? That's the difference between the stuff that appears in the start menu and all programs. It isn't the case that everything's a peer in the start menu.
Well, then you get into the whole kind of the start menu as collapsing itself with the automatic chevron collapsing, right? Where the start menu says, so here are the things that you ordinarily click on.
Well, so it's a dual. At that point, it plays a dual responsibility, right? In the you've never used it before. It's the here are the things you're most likely to want to click on first. And then over time, it learns what you most often or most recently clicked on. And then it personalizes itself to you.
Have you used the new start menu in Vista, right?
Yeah.
Does it do the same thing? Because I think it pretty much shows you everything.
Well, you can view
river of programs kind of view.
Well, so when we can go check it on Vista, but the way I remember it was there's still this idea of two tiers, right?
Yeah.
Right, which is here's the stuff you're most likely want to click on, and
I kind of miss the program manager. I'm going to write that. I'm going to write that in WPF. I'm going to write a program manager, which is just going to be a place to throw stuff.
And if you could keep the old Windows 3.1 look and feel.
Yeah, I'll do that as a theme. That'll be awesome.
That would be awesome.
Well, this is now officially the longest Hansel Minutes ever, looking at darn near an hour.
Did we actually have a topic?
I don't know. I'm worried we wasted people's time. Remember, the whole mission statement of Hansel Minutes is to not waste time. So I would recommend you listen to this show in quadruple speed.
So actually, I'm a huge fan of that. I always download your stuff and then do it at 1.5 speed. Because, in fact, Microsoft has meetings and stuff, and they have online corporate training. And if it wasn't... There are a lot of cases where I prefer to miss a meeting and then play it back at 1.5 speed. I just like that better.
It's awesome.
Yeah. Yep.
Technology is all organized to enable our attention deficit disorder, basically, right?
Enable. It's like, encouraging. It's creating.
So here's a dirty little secret that we'll end on. So I was using the replay TV, right? TiVo, DVR yesterday. And my wife came down and she says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm watching Dancing with the Stars. She says, but it's too fast. Well, I was skimming Dancing with the Stars. I was playing Dancing with the Stars back in 5x speed. It was a 2-hour show. It was the results show, right? I want to know who's going to win.
Right.
I do want to see some of the dancing.
So instead of skipping ahead 30 seconds at a time,
I put it on fast forward.
You put it on fast forward.
And I watched the whole thing in 20 minutes.
I actually used to do that with my VCR. I used to watch. I'd have like this movie. I'm like, well, I don't know if it's going to be good or not. I got 20 minutes. I know. I'll watch it at... You know, fast forward, and I can see the whole... And it's amazing how little you need the dialogue if it's a bad movie.
You know, the Comcast DVR that I use, the Motorola DVR that Comcast Cable gives you, if you play it in double speed with the closed captioning on, the closed captioning will still be there.
So you just have to read really fast.
Right. So if you can read fast enough, you can put it in double X speed.
I think... You know, we talk sometimes about the various gaps between various layers of our society. I think that the real gap is the knowledge consumption gap, right? How fast, because this is huge avalanche of data, how fast can I squeeze it into my brain? And as soon as we get to squeezing entertainment into our brain, then we know we've gone totally around the bend.
I felt like I had 2 solid hours of good Dancing with Celebrities stuffed into my brain, but I'm not willing to give them 2 hours of my time. I'm willing to give them 20 minutes of my time.
I think that sounds like a personal problem to me. Yes.
And on that note, this has been our very first interview of Hansel Minutes with Chris Sells. Thank you, Chris, for having me over to your house.
It has been a pleasure.